from the State Attorney General Joe Meyer's point of view.
I know.
She took her time before speaking again. You should seriously consider whether you might have happened to have seen the reflection in the window of Felix Polk holding that gun to the back of your head.
I didn't say anything.
The food came along, with a few biscuits for Dog. Thanks, Larry. You guys calling it a day? They've closed the highway. He smiled and shouted as I handed Vic the bag of food and stuffed the biscuits in my pocket to give to Dog later. Yeah, we're going home while we can still make it. I smiled back as he handed me our drinks and quickly slid his window closed. I hit the button to roll up mine, a spray of wayward flakes swirling in the open window as I watched Vic lodge her coffee into the passenger cup holder and mine into the center one. A jug of wine, a loaf of bread, and thou. My dissertation was interrupted by Ruby. Static. Unit 1, this is base. Come in. Vic looked at the radio and unwrapped her dashburger. Your truck, your radio. I sighed and pulled the mic from the holder. Ruby was still trying to win us over to a more business-like attitude toward radio communication, and everybody had pretty much caved except for me. What? Static. I just got a weather report. I keyed the mic. How much are we supposed to get? There was a bit of jostling before the next communique, and it became obvious where Ruby had found reinforcements. Static. Ass deep to a 9-foot Indian. I keyed the mic again. Hello, Lucian. Static. What the hell are you doing out there? Checking on the remainder of the Stewart clan. Static. They say we're going to get 18 inches by tomorrow morning. I won't tarry. Static. See that you don't. I brought my chessboard with me. By the time we got to the dump-slash-junkyard, Vic had fed Dog his burger and half of hers. I'd eaten mine in 4 bites, and was just now finishing off my fries as we arrived at the Stewart driveway. Mike Thomas was leaving as we got there, so we slowed and stopped. He pulled the 78 orange Ford alongside my truck and rolled his window down. "What are you doing out in this weather, Mike? Neighborhood watch?" He shrugged under his insulated coat and frowned, throwing a thumb back to the top-covered heap in the bed of his truck. "Was going to drop a load off at the dump, but Gina said they were closed today and waved me off." I looked up to emphasize the point. "Well, it is kind of inclement. I'm off to the Caribbean tomorrow if it ever stops, and wanted to clear out my shop." He leveled an eye on me. "In 16 years I've never seen a workday when G.O. Stewart closed. I guess it's all different now that he's gone." "You heard?" "Yep, and when I pulled up to the house to see what was going on, Gina was piling stuff into that piece of shit Toronado again like she was pretty intent on going somewhere else." I glanced at Vic, then back to the sculptor. "You sure she wasn't unloading? We caught her on 16 the last time you called and turned her back." He thought about it. "Hell, she might have been unloading for all I know." "Well, we'll go in and check on her." He shook his head and began rolling up his window. "Good luck." The Toronado was parked in the driveway close to the house, but the snow on it had been swiped off recently. I stopped behind it and threw the truck into park. "Let's go." Dog started his leap over the center console and into the front. "Not you. If those two beasts of theirs are in there, I don't need you starting anything." He looked disappointed, but I left the windows down a little and shut the door after me. Vic was at the front of the truck when I got there. She glanced up at me. "I'm assuming you didn't mean me." We trudged through the snow to the driver's side door of the Toronado. "Does that look like more crap than was in there before?" My deputy peered through the frosted window. "Arf." I studied the prints leading up to the house and onto the porch. 3 trips, at least. It appeared that Gina was still intent on leaving, even with the weather and the warning. The conversation with Duane hadn't been as bad as I'd assumed it would be, considering the nature of the subject matter. When she told him she was pregnant and that the father was not him, he seemed surprised, but not particularly upset. In the amount of time I'd been contemplating the Stewart social order, another 1/4 inch of snow had accumulated on the two of us. Without another word, we picked our way among the fresh prints to the house and met Gina coming out with a laundry basket full of clothes.
"Howdy."
She started with a short scream and almost dropped the basket.
Jesus Christ!
Sorry. Vic and I stepped onto the porch in an attempt to not accumulate even more snow. What are you doing, Gina? She dropped the light blue plastic laundry basket after the question and took the smoldering cigarette from the corner of her mouth.
Leaving.
We told you to stick around.
Yeah, well.
She glanced back into the open doorway of the house.
Grampus is dead, Dwayne's in jail, and I'm getting the fuck out of here. I don't give a shit what you told me to do.
Butch and Sundance appeared in the doorway, protective of Gina and obviously concerned that we were abusing their mistress. Butch, the one that had bitten me in the ass, was the nearest and was growling. In case you haven't noticed, the weather is pretty brutal, and the HPs have closed all the highways. She took a strong puff on the cigarette. Pregnancy be damned.
Fuck it, I'm still leaving, and you can't stop me.
I let that pass. Something happened?
Morris came over, and I told him about the baby, and he went all apeshit.
Gio's brother, Morris?
Yeah, he's upstairs going through some of Grampus's stuff.
I don't know if I've ever heard him speak three words. I could feel my headache coming back and wondered if they really had anything to do with my eye. Would you like me to speak to him?
No, fuck it, I'm leaving.
You're not going to get very far.
I don't care. She started to bend over and pick up the basket. I'm leaving.
I'm sorry, but you're not. The dogs caught my tone, even if she hadn't, and were now both growling. Vic unsnapped the safety strap on her Glock.
Call them off or I'll throw a warning shot through both their fucking heads.
When you go to a dog fight, it's always good to bring the meanest bitch. Gina casually glanced back and then screamed at them,
Shut up!
The dogs went immediately silent. Gina, if you leave here now, you're not going to go anywhere except a ditch, and then we're going to have to pull you out. Just stay put and let me talk to Morris, and then, if we have to, we'll give you an escort to a motel, okay? She looked even more sullen than usual, turned with her load, and went back into the house of Usher, followed by the two hounds of the Baskervilles. There were more things piled by the doorway than I would have guessed would fit in the classic, but who was I to judge? Where is Morris?
Upstairs in Grampus's room. He said he was going to get Grampus's gun and shoot me.
Vic and I looked at each other. Really? She studied me as if I were a variety of moron she'd never met before.
Yeah, really?
You stay here with Vic and I'll go upstairs.
Fine by me. I'm going to get a pop in the kitchen.
You guys wait for me in there. Vic nodded, and I took a step up the stairway.
Morris, it's Walt Longmire. Are you up there?
Nothing. It was odd, and I found it hard to believe that Morris Stewart would have responded in the manner she described.
Morris, Sheriff's Department coming up the stairs.
Nothing. It was my first time in the inner sanctum of the house, and from the look of things on the landing, the upstairs wasn't any better than the downstairs. Junk cluttered the steps and continued down the hallway. There was a path down the middle, but car parts, stacks of papers, magazines, and cans of paint were stacked on either side. The place was an arsonist's dream. I thought about how they cleaned the chimney with a mop full of kerosene and shuddered.
Morris, are you up here?
There were six doorways in the hall. Five of them had the doors closed, with the sixth, the one at the end, slightly ajar. I picked my way through the debris and placed a hand on my sidearm.
Morris?
I opened the nearest door. It was obviously Dwayne and Gina's. There were car posters on the walls and a huge canopy bed that looked like it might have been bought at a discount furniture place, the kind you see in tents alongside the road. The only light in the room was a digital clock that was an hour off. I stared at it for a few moments, thinking that there was something about it that was important, something about that clock and the time. I decided I'd start at the other end of the hallway with the door that was slightly open and work my way back. The floor creaked under my boots, and I started feeling like Gina trapped in the Adams family mansion.
Morris?
I nudged the door open. The gauze-like curtain on the other side of the room was flowing like the oversized sleeve of a ghost, to complete the analogy, and snow was piling up on the floor underneath the window. I moved to close it and go on to the next room, when I saw something lying in a single bed to the left. It was a tiny, fold-out cot, really, but piled with sheets, blankets, and even a moldy buffalo hide. On closer inspection, the thing had horsehair tails hanging from the edges and intricate beading indicative of the late 18th century, probably worth a fortune but for the holes and the hair that was falling off of it. Something moved under the pile of coverings, and I took the couple of steps to the bedside. Morris? Whatever it wasn't moving any more, so I reached forward and peeled the blankets back. It was Morris, and there was a great deal of blood saturated in the dirty sheets. The blood had come from a bullet wound in his chest, almost identical to the wound that Ozzie Dobbs had sustained. Then his eyes flew open. Jesus! His mouth began moving, but no words came out. Morris, stay still, I'll get you some help. I pulled my radio from my belt and hit the button. Vic, are you there? Nothing. Vic? I released the button and yelled down the hallway in a voice I was sure could be heard in the kitchen. Vic! I placed a hand on the old man's shoulder. I'm going to go get help. I'll be right back. Hold on, Morris. I punched the button and yelled into the radio. Base, this is Unit 1. Come in. As I rushed down the hall and toward the stairs, Ruby's voice came through the speaker. Unit 1, this is Base. Over. As I passed Duane and Gina's room, it dawned on me why it was important that the clock was an hour off. That Duane had said Gina had left for work by the time he'd gotten up from his nap, but in reality she'd reset the clock and gone out to kill Gio. I jammed the radio to my mouth. Ruby, get me back up over at the Stewart place. Static. Who? Anybody, everybody, get me EMTs, too. Morris Stewart has been shot and is bleeding to death. Hurry! I reached the landing and turned to find the front door once again hanging open, but I cut left toward the kitchen. I stalled at the swinging door I'd first seen Betty Dobbs walk through and could see Vic lying on the floor, blood on her head. I ran to her. I could feel the pressure of my own body exploding from the inside. I gently pushed my arm under her shoulder and pulled her toward me and up from the floor. I froze as her head lolled to one side and I could feel the air leap from my mouth. No way, not like this, not here. She gasped a short breath, and it was then that I could see she was still breathing. Her next words were quintessential. Fuck me. I held her head and spotted a frying pan big enough and old enough to have fed the whole 7th Cavalry. It was lying on the floor by the refrigerator, along with a large amount of spilled fried potatoes. There was a spot on it that was bloodied and held a tuft of brunette hair. I held her face up to mine. She stirred again, and a hand came up, glancing off my arm and then dropping again. What the fuck? Her other hand came up and latched onto my sleeve. Are you all right? My head. That bitch. Her eyes opened, and I could see where a blood vessel had burst in her left one. What the hell did she hit me with? Looks like a frying pan. I guess you should be happy she didn't have her gun. I propped her up a bit. Are you okay? No, my head. Yeah, I'm good. She started to sit up, but her equilibrium was off, and she wavered in my arms. Shit! I pulled her toward the kitchen cabinets and leaned her against them. I've got backup coming with medical. Mara Stewart's upstairs where she shot him in the chest, just like Ozzie Dobbs. Do you believe he's still alive? She stretched her jaw, and I could hear the popping noise. When we're all dead, the only thing that'll still be alive will be cockroaches and a Stewart. She was all right. Any idea where Gina and the dogs went? She tried to shake her head. No idea. Did you check the car? No, but we've got her blocked in, and I've got the keys. She sighed, and I could tell it hurt. I'll check. Her hand slipped, and she jarred back onto her butt. Stay. When the troops show up, tell them Morris is upstairs in the last bedroom to the left. I stood. She looked at me. Where are you going? I pulled the .45 from my holster. Hunting. I could see from her prints in the fresh snow where she'd tried the car, but then that she had turned and gone back in, the dog tracks following hers. There was melted snow from her shoes and the dog's paws that led down the stairs to the basement. I turned the knob, but it was locked again. I reared back and planted a size 13 into the wood by the knob plate and caught myself in the doorway as the wood exploded under the stairs. I listened, but there was no noise from below, just the cold air from what I now knew was the cellar tunnel.
I flipped on the light switch and continued down the steps. She could have gotten her gun, but wouldn't have taken the risk of finishing off Vic, since she knew I'd be coming down the steps pretty quickly. She was used to taking her victims unaware and at close range. She might get lucky with the .32 if I came at her, or she might not. Then, there were the dogs. As I turned the corner at the landing, my radio crackled. "Walt, it's Ruby." I pulled the radio up as I aimed the Colt at large into the darkened basement. "Kinda busy here." Static. "Walt, Santiago is here and says he's got more information on Felix Polk." "Put him on." Static. "Boss, the name Polk didn't come up as an inmate in Huntsville, so I did a search for a Felix P. and found a Felix Polson who did time for killing a garage owner in San Antonio." It was silent for a moment. "Gotta be the same guy, boss. His next hit was the stretch in San Quentin for kidnapping a woman in Utah and killing her. Same name, Felix Polson." Where had I heard that name before? I keyed the mic again. "Is there any mention of next of kin contact?" Static. "Kayla." I flipped the lights on and looked around with the radio over my mouth. "Have we got people coming?" Static. "Yes, everybody's on their way. Morris is in the bedroom upstairs and Vic is on the floor in the kitchen." Static. "What happened to Vic?" "Fortunately, she was assaulted with a frying pan." Static. "Fortunately?" I keyed the mic again. "It was a hell of a sight better than the .32 Gina used on her great-uncle-in-law." I clipped the radio to my belt and continued to check the basement. There was no one there, man, woman, or beast. I watched the air blow the blue plastic that covered the opening in the old house's foundation back toward me, along with the cold from the other end. The 4x4 attached to the bottom of the tarp was kicked sideways, and I was pretty sure it was where she and the dogs had gone. It was the only way out to the tow trucks that were the only other working vehicles. I moved to the opening and shifted the wood on the floor to the opposite side. It was dark in the tunnel, and I reached up to the right where I could feel the junction box and switch. I flipped it, and absolutely nothing happened. Damn. I pulled my maglite from my belt and directed it into the tunnel. The batteries were starting to fade. I'd been using it so much lately. Polson. Where had I heard that name? The weak beam of the flashlight only penetrated the gloom of the tunnel for so far, and the only things I could see were a few cardboard boxes, a stack of mulch, and another of fertilizer. Sizer Vittoria had done a pretty good job of cleaning out the place. It was such a shame that it turned out to be a swan song. I started into the jagged opening and had gone about a dozen steps when I felt the air pressure in the confined space change. The cold was like a wall, and I could feel it increase as I stood there. I listened carefully, but could only hear a scrambling noise. It was about then that I heard the breathing of something at the end of the tunnel, something running. I raised the flashlight again and could plainly see a single set of golden eyes moving fast and headed my way. Chapter 16. At least it was only one set of eyes. Something in me hesitated as I brought the large frame Colt up. I remembered how Butch had licked my hand. Maybe it was the ranch boy in me, maybe it was just being stupid, but I wasn't willing to kill the less ferocious of the dogs. If he got to me and there was no choice, well, then there was no choice. But what if it wasn't Butch? A lot of this stuff was passing through my mind in the few seconds it took the dog to race down the tunnel. I had learned how to handle a dog in a death struggle in the Corps. In boot, they'd given us a chance against a few extremely well-trained German shepherds, an 8-man squad, and we'd all lost badly. Hypothetically, the trick was to feed the dog your passive forearm, then wrap your other around its neck and push, effectively breaking the dog's neck. The instructor said that it usually worked, unless the dog was large and powerful, in which case his jaws could break the proffered arm, making it doubly difficult to concentrate on step two. He also said that if the dog was trained properly, it would leap for the arm, but then at the last instant go underneath and clamp its jaws around your throat. A recruit had asked what you did at that point, and the instructor said he'd heard that if you stick a finger in the attacking dog's anus, the animal would break off the attack. Intra-squad consensus was that you'd have just as good a chance if you stuck the digit up your own asshole. I set my feet and kept the butt of the .45 ready to bring down on the dog's head. I could see him plainly now, but it was impossible to tell which one it was. He looked like he meant business, though. I braced my legs for the impact and then suddenly remembered the only other weapon I had at hand, my voice. Just as he was shortening his stride to time a leap, I yelled, "Butch, bad dog, down!" It was as if someone had cut off the fuel, and he landed at my feet a little clumsily. His head was between his paws as he looked up at me with the glow of the flashlight in his eyes. He wagged his tail in supplication just a bit, and then was motionless. "Good boy," his head rose. "Come here." He stood and turned, sitting his behind on my boots. "Good boy, good boy." I ruffled his ears, stroking the silky hair at the back of his neck, and remembered the biscuits that Larry had given me at the drive-thru. I pulled one out and gave it to him. That left me with another biscuit for Sundance, an item likely to be as helpful as an accordion on an elk hunt. With the experiences of the last few months, I had to remember to carry an entire assortment of animal treats with me. Good boy, good boy! I started down the tunnel again, this time with a wagging companion. I didn't think I could get him to stay, so I let him tag along, figuring that I could close the door at the end of the tunnel to keep him from joining Sundance if Gina put him on me. When I got to the end, I could see that the snow had crept in the doorway and held the door open a few inches. I looked down at my companion, still wagging. "This is as far as you go, buddy." I buttoned my sheepskin coat, flipped up the collar, and pulled down my hat. I wedged the door back far enough to get a leg through and just hoped that Gina wasn't waiting on the other side with a .32 pistol. It was dark, and the darting snowflakes stung. I dropped my face down into my coat and tried not to think about how my skin already stung, my foot already hurt, and about the bite wound on my left cheek. Butch had tried to follow after me, but I brushed him back with my boot and shoved the cellar door closed. I again figured if he got together with Sundance and Gina, he was more likely to run with the pack. I turned into the night and wondered where my pack was. Visibility was no more than 20 feet. I looked around for prints, but the gusts had filled anything that was out here. The wind was coming straight out of the North Pole, and there were no stars or moon. I looked toward the ridge in hopes of seeing something that might indicate that she'd gone that way, but there was nothing but drifts, running like shallow sea waves toward the southeast. I looked toward the gated walkway that led to the quarry, but there was nothing there either. She had to be after the tow trucks. They were solid and had four-wheel drive and weren't blocked in by my three-quarter ton. Had to be. I post-holed my way toward the junkyard below, aware that if I went in the wrong direction, I could take a 75-foot header. The wind had scoured the edge of the cliff, and the pathway became more evident as I got to the gate, which was swinging freely in the wind. I could see boot prints now and figured I should move as quickly as I could, since there was no way Gina would stay out in this weather any longer than absolutely needed. If she was going for the tow trucks, she'd be going for them fast. It was easier going downhill, and the wind wasn't as bad inside the quarry. The snow had been accumulating with a vengeance and was about 2 feet deep in the junkyard itself, but at least the visibility had improved to the point where I could now see about 30 feet, which was the length of one of those behemoths they made back in the 40s and 50s. It was easy to feel small and alone in the muffled quiet of the snow amid all that dead hardware. It was hard enough for me with my long legs to move quickly in the deep drifts, and I wondered about the desperation that must have forced Gina to try. I thought I saw something ahead, and stopped by a 66 Belvedere with a Buick stacked on top of it and a Ford sedan on top of that. It was only when the ricochet of a .32 slug caromed off the quarter panel of the Plymouth that I became really sure. I jumped back to the rear of the coupe with all the agility of a circus bear and peered around the taillight. "Gina, it's the sheriff. There isn't anywhere to go. I've got people on the way and they're going to block off the gate, so you better just give it up now." I hoped the part about the people was true. My answer was another round from the .32, which disappeared somewhere behind me, and the barking of the dog. I figured I'd flank her and continue down the next row and try to cut her off before she got to the trucks. A high step to my right, and hoped she and the dog hadn't had the same idea as I made my way along the other side of the car tower. I tried to remember how many rows there were before the main thoroughfare that held the office and the straight shot to the gate, and was thinking three before I hit the turn of the century in motor vehicle manufacture and crossed the road. I hurried through the 70s and the 80s, and was just making it to the 90s when I thought I saw something ahead again.
It was smaller than me, and, more important, it wasn't standing upright. I stood there breathing heavily, most of my energy drained from slogging through the snow, and waited. That primordial stem at the back of my brain shot a jolt through me, the same jolt that it